Thank you, Pratik. Well, this is going to be interesting. It's a pleasure to be speaking to people as part of the virtual program at this conference. This whole talk is a little bit last minute, so technology-wise as well as PDF-wise, so we'll see how it goes. But I guess I also know the people who are there in Perimeter are trying to get to a banquet at 6, so I'm going to try to actually go slowly through the first part of the talk so we can follow things. Then I may go rapidly so folks can get the punchline and go to dinner. Then I might slow down for people who remain on video and want to hear more of you. So Pratik, can you tell me when 20 minutes have passed? Okay, that'll give me a good cue. All right, so I'm going to tell you about some work that hopefully will appear very soon with Eugenia Kolafrancheschi, Ji Dong, and Jin-Chun Wang. And let me just sort of dive in to explain the motivation of what we're trying to do and I'll tell you what we're doing. All right, oops.
Oh, you might have to click on the shared screen.
Click on the shared screen to advance the slide.
Just to be on the window, and now you should be able to hear.
Yeah. Got it. Whoa. Yes, that's right. Okay, great. So what is our motivation? Well, to get you the right frame of mind, think of a standard discussion of Ryu Takinagi entropy, which we talk about in ADS-CFT all the time. I'm going to change context. This should set the right frame of mind. So imagine you're doing some, we'll call it a bulk gravitational path integral. We've got some boundary conditions that look something like a cylinder, kind of sets up a thermal field double-like state. And I want to consider the context where the T equals zero slice of the bulk, if you will, has two boundaries, we'll call B and B bar, because they're both, in this context, boundaries. In order to avoid divergences, I want to consider the context where the two regions of RT fame are each compact and without boundary. So a T equals zero slice through a typical bulk geometry of a saddle might look like the picture on the right, or is it the left, the right, where you have two boundaries, B and B bar, and an RT surface. And just to be clear, my symbols B and B bar are both objects that are boundaries in the sense that they are codimension two from the bulk point of view. Okay, so in this context, we'd expect there's an RT entropy, A over 4G plus corrections. And how do we understand what that means? Well, if there is a dual CFT, we understand that in this context, because I chose the Bs to be complete boundaries, and it actually doesn't matter if each B is connected. B could be 5 circles, B bar could be 17 circles. It doesn't matter as long as they're both closed. But because I've chosen the Bs to be compact and without boundary, if there's a dual CFT, we understand that this is a context where there's a Hilbert space that factorizes into some HB, tensor HB bar, and the RT entropy describes the entropy of the associated density matrix in the standard sense of quantum mechanics that's going to be induced on either factor by some pure state. So our motivation for this project is to try to understand how much of the above story we can, in some sense, derive from the bulk without invoking ADS-CFT. And there is various clues in the recent literature that suggest we should be able to do at least something. One of those is the page curve story, where there's an analog of this, but now one of the boundary regions, B, becomes a non-gravitating band. And in that context, we understand that our recent calculations of the page curve are manipulations of the bulk path integral, and they don't really care if there's a dual CFT or not. They just calculate the entropy of the bath in a standard sense. We've got some noise coming in from someplace. I suspect that someone is muting a microphone. I just meant that. You got it, Pratik?
You're the host only.
I'm the host. I think people in the reflecting room at Alex? All right, somebody took care of it. Great. So the other example of this recently is the Chandrasekhar and Longo Pennington-Witten story, or the Pennington-Witten story about JT, where they show using, which really only bulk techniques, that in fact you can define a type 2 algebra, and there's a notion of entropy on that algebra which is connected with RT. Now, we'd like to do a little bit, we'd like to go beyond that, because in that case you get type 2 algebras, it's not quite the same, it's not exactly the story that we want, but its motivation that at least something can be done. Also, that story, well, it's wonderful, and you can do what you can do there because they work in a semi-classical limit of a certain kind where things are under control. In the JT gravity story, what I mean by a semi-classical limit is they take the limit of large S naught, so their fluctuations topology are suppressed. But in that case, it's a limit. And I'd like to do something, well, I'd like to try to talk about what happens when you don't take a limit, when you consider the full bulk theory, whatever that might mean. And then, of course, I won't obtain RT exactly. I mean, I want to have a framework where we sort of, I'd like to put together a conceptual framework for the bulk full theory in terms of which we can understand the RT entropy as a limit. Okay, that's the motivation. Now, what are we actually going to do? Because I've already used a lot of my time. Well, as I said, I'd like to study the bulk theory. And I'm ambitious here. I'd like to understand it in finite couplings, not just in the semi-classical limit. But that raises the question, what do we mean by a bulk theory? If I try to talk about a bulk path integral, what is that? How do I sum over geometries, blah, 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 blah. I don't want to answer those questions. I don't even try to answer them here. Nevertheless, I want to say the words Euclidean bulk path integral as motivation. The approach I want to take for this talk is to suppose that some extremely clever person, not me, has found a UV completion of a bulk gravitation, quantum gravity theory. I don't care how they found it, but they found it and they give it to me. And I want to manipulate it. Okay. Now, obviously, if I know nothing about that theory, I can't do anything. But what I want to do is to assume that whatever black box they hand me satisfies a certain short list of axioms, and then I'm going to play mathematician, and I'll see what I can derive. And what I think is interesting about this talk is how short the list of axioms is, how relatively simple and I think uncontroversial they are, and how much you can get out of it. So that's the game. So I will lay my cards on the table by showing you the axioms, and then I'll try to explain the results. Okay, so here are the axioms. All of these are things that I think are standard. The first one just says that the path integral is a machine. The UV completion of a quantum gravity theory I've been handed, I will assume it's a machine that takes smooth manifolds that I can think of as boundary conditions for some asymptotically locally ADS bulk. I'll fix that asymptotically locally ADS context for simplicity anyway. And that this UV completion of a quantum gravity theory, which I will call a Euclidean path integral, gives me a number for each smooth manifold fold with appropriate fields on it. And as an example, I might hope that one such theory gives me a function of this kind, which is well-defined for every, say, smooth three-dimensional Euclidean manifold with a smooth Euclidean metric and maybe all possible scalar fields that might represent some kind of boundary condition for a bulk scalar. That's the kind of space of fields on which I want my, quote, path integral to be defined. And again, what I really mean is, again, just that this UV completion of bulk theory finds some way of assigning numbers to those manifolds, I think it was finding boundary conditions, which obey the following axioms. The first one is that it makes sense on the smooth manifolds. The second one is that because I'm thinking about this as Euclidean path integral, it's real in the obvious sense. I'm not going to explain the details of all these axioms because they're very standard. The third is I want it to satisfy reflection positivity. If it doesn't, we're going to have a real problem because I'm going to use it to build a Hilbert space in the usual way, and I'm not going to apologize for it. I make that assumption. I will need a continuity assumption. Continuity, so the path integral was a function from a space of boundary conditions to complex numbers. We could have a long discussion about the sense in which it should be continuous. What I'm going to need for this talk is what I think is a very weak and uncontroversial notion of continuity. Presumably, any actual interesting theory satisfies some stronger notion whose details I don't care about. So here's the notion I need. I'm going to suppose I'm given a manifold that I think of as giving boundary conditions. I'm going to suppose that somewhere in that manifold, this gray area in my figure, the manifold takes the form of a cylinder, meaning by which I mean it is the Cartesian product with an interval. And let me just specify it at that level. If that is the case, if the manifold already contains a finite cylinder of some finite size epsilon naught, I would like to assume that if I change the size of that cylinder slightly without changing the rest of the manifold, so I'm just inserting a little, making the gray area a little taller and not changing the domes, that the path integral as a function from manifolds to complex numbers responds continuously just under that one kind of change. And the last axiom I want is I want my path integral to satisfy the factorization property that we know and love from ADS-CFT. I will say more about that a couple of times throughout the talk. I guess as a point of perspective, I do not want to assume there is a complete dual CFT. Of course, if there were, I think all of these axioms are clearly satisfied. And again, what's interesting is the fact that this is, at least on the surface, a lot weaker than the full set of axioms for a CFT. In particular, there's nothing about locality in here. And yet we will still be able to do something related to our RT story. I will make one more comment about the axioms before I proceed, which is the one axiom here that I personally don't like as written and that I'm not entirely happy with is the factorization. I would love to start with the other four and in some sense derive the factorizations. And you know, you can actually get kind of what for a physicist is close, although for a mathematician is still far away. I'm not going to go into this in detail now. I may see a little bit later. What I'd really like to, we have plenty of toy models that show us that 1 through 4 don't actually imply factorization per se. What 1 through 4 might imply is something you call effective factorization, which means effective factorization, that's not going to work, meaning, effective factorization is here, meaning that the path integral might in some sense decompose into a direct sum over baby universe super selection sectors so that in each super selection sector, factorization holds, and then I can just treat the path integral sector by sector. So in other words, I could also imagine a scenario where you give me this UV completion of a bulk quantum gravity theory, and a priori it doesn't satisfy number 5, but you can write it as a sum of terms that all satisfy 5, in which case we can just use each distinct sector by sector. You can almost derive that from a physicist's standpoint. You can derive a lot of it, but there are obstacles to really deriving it in the mathematician sense associated with the existence with just trying to control unbounded operators on Hilbert spaces. And unbounded operators are a nightmare if you don't already know things about their self-adjoint extensions. So I'm gonna make that cryptic comment and I'll come back later. What's interesting though, is that if you assume that that part gets controlled by having this factorization axiom hold, at least on super selection sectors, there are no more mathematical issues, at least so far as I can tell. The mathematicians will correct me. All right, so we take these axioms. What am I gonna do? Well, as advertised, I'm going to now build a Hilbert space in the standard way you do with a path integral. I will imagine that, the first axiom I had was that if you give me a space of closed manifolds without boundary, of course, the path integral gives me a number. So we all know that you can then make a Hilbert space of states by considering path integrals with evaluated on surfaces that have boundaries. So now I'll suppose that for simplicity, there are 2 boundaries to set up the right scenario I want. There's a boundary B and a boundary B bar. Okay. I'm going to consider a simple case where the manifold with boundary has one of these cylinders here and also here living near each boundary, meaning that I'm only going to allow these manifolds with boundary that are really sort of straight, if you will, they're locally products with interval near either boundary. And that's going to be the case because I want to restrict to that case because it will allow me to glue things together in a nice way. In particular, if I have 2 of these, if I have a surface I call A and another surface I call B, and if they have the same boundaries, B and B bar, in the sense they both have appropriate cylinders, then it makes sense to take these 2 surfaces, glue them together over here as at left And I should have included a complex conjugation on the top one in case there are complex sources, but I forgot to draw that in the picture. And I will declare that these two objects define states and that their inner product is given by the path integral over this manifold I form by gluing things together. No surprise, we always do. Fine. There are some comments, if you don't get confused. It turns out that you need to consider points on the boundaries B and B bar as being labeled so that there's a unique way of gluing them that matches labels. We don't just glue them up to diffeomorphisms. And again, I'm only computing inner products for states with matching rims. So I can do this for states A and B because they both have B, B bar boundaries. Okay, almost to my 20 minute mark where I'm supposed to accelerate. So there's a Hilbert space. Right, guess what? There are also operators in the Hilbert space defined in the obvious way. If a state is defined, I skipped the mathematical step. The mathematical step is what I've actually defined so far is a pre-Hilbert space. I need to end up with an inner product. The inner product is positive definite on the pre-Hilbert space by reflection positivity, by the axiom. I need a quotient by null states and complete in the usual way. I'm going to do that. All right. If I actually have a state defined by an actual surface, then I can take another surface and I can glue it to that state thing. So if the state here I call B is defined by some surface called B, I can define a new state, the action of A on B, by gluing in a surface with similar boundaries. And I'm just going to leave it at the pictures and not say too many words because time is pressing. I think the idea is pretty clear. And yes, I know that when I draw this picture, I am defining a densely defined operator on a dense subspace of my Hilbert space. We need to deal with appropriate limits. Okay, I'm going fast to get to the magic step. This is piece number one of the magic. So I want to go through this slightly slowly because this is, the experts will start to get excited after this, I hope. The operators that I have defined by gluing surfaces together surfaces are all bounded operators as a consequence of my axioms. And that's interesting. And what's interesting about it is that the operators were defined to have, I drew them as things with two boundaries. So here I've drawn my blue surfaces, I've labeled them as states, but it doesn't really matter. Can I go back? Click on the thing. There we go. Doesn't matter with the purple thing. I mean, there's a blue surface that defines a blue state, but of course, there's a corresponding surface that defines an operator. So as long as I'm talking about surfaces and not arbitrary states that live in the completion of the Hilbert space, I can be sloppy about what's a state and what's an operator. Okay. I do want to. I didn't emphasize it here. I'm specializing to what I would have called the diagonal case from before. So I want the two boundaries, which are previously called B and B bar, I want them to be the same. I'm just going to think about that case. What's interesting is that to derive my claim that these are bounded operators, well, the operator is defined by a surface with two boundaries, B and B. That's what this means, B and B. To derive the fact that it's bounded, I need to think about a construction involving the Hilbert space associated with 1, 2, 3, 4 copies of B. And here's how it works. So if I have 4 copies of B, then there is some state in that Hilbert space defined by a disconnected surface where the first surface has two boundaries, and it's surface A, which would have defined a state A in the two boundary Hilbert space. There's a second piece, which is the surface B, which would have defined a state B in the two-boundary Hilbert space. All right. And what this picture on the right is supposed to say is that it's just hard to draw these fancy blue tubes. I'm going to simplify the notation. So I'm now drawing it as a one-dimensional boundary instead of as a two-dimensional boundary. So this is one of the states in this four-boundary Hilbert space. And just like all the points on B are labeled, the copies of B are labeled. And I've given the names here. Left one, right one, left two, right two. Those are just names. But I've used that to explain the details of which state I'm talking about. The A state has boundaries that are the left one and right one copies. The B state has boundaries that are left two and right two copies. The notation here should then be transparent. But there's another state where I just swap the two left boundaries. So now it's B that connects the left one boundary to, well, I didn't swap the right boundary, to the right two boundary. So B now connects left one and right one. And A now connects right one and left two. All right. Let's do some calculations involving those states. We can compute their norms. Well, to compute the norms, you just glue one state to a copy of itself, and it's pretty clear that that gives you a factorizing construction. It gives you a disconnected boundary, and the answer is the product of the norm of A and the product of the norm of B. The inner product of the two states is more interesting, because you see, if I glue this top line to this bottom line, I get something that looks kind of like this. Everything gets connected. Try to trace through it. And if you trace through in detail what this looks like in terms of my previous construction, it's the same thing as computing the expect, oh, there shouldn't be a star over here. It's the same as the expectation value in the state B of the operator A dagger A. So it's the expectation value of a positive operator. So in particular, it's real and positive, which means I must get the same thing if I took the inner product the other way, if I Hermitian conjugate everything. All right. So that's interesting. We have two states. Their norm, the norm of both, the norm of each state separately is the product of norm A and norm B. The inner product of the two states is this expectation value. And so that means that you can do some magic, which is apply the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. And the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality tells you that the inner product of two states is left bounded by the square root of the product of their norms. So the inner product of my states was this. Again, that shouldn't be a B star. This is the expectation value of A dagger A. And it's bounded by the product of the norms of my four boundary states, each of which was the product of norms of two boundary states. So there's both of these things come out squared. You get the square root, you get this. But this relation is exactly the statement that the norm of the operator A is bounded by, question how you say it, but the norm of the operator A dagger A is bounded by the norm of the state A. So in particular, all the operators we define are bounded. And so now you can run all the machinery of von Neumann algebras. If you have an algebra of bounded operators, you can always complete them into an algebra of von Neumann algebras. And the nifty thing is that these algebras, I think you didn't warn me in 20 minutes, but that's all right. the nifty thing is that, as in every other talk on this subject, these algebras have useful traces. And if you have an actual surface, so this is in my, just the surfaces, the set of surfaces get completed to a von Neumann algebra. We're not there yet. If you have an actual surface, there's an obvious notion of a trace where the trace of at least A dagger A is the same as the norm of A, and it's the same as what I've shown down here. It's the obvious path integral trace thing. We just glue stuff together. Okay. The interesting thing, which I'll just mention, I don't have to prove this, is that you can write that in a fancy way involving supremums of some regulated things, where you can show that the norm, the trace extends to the entire von Neumann algebra as a faithful, normal, semi-finite trace. So we can do things with it. Okay. Here's the other interesting thing. Let's not worry about the extension yet. Let's just take the definition of the trace on surfaces. Well, I just showed you this nifty inequality, which said that the product of norm A with norm B is greater than or equal to, again, this should be B not B star, the expectation value of A dagger A in the B state. In an obvious notation, you could write that as the norm of a different state. There shouldn't be stars on either of these things, where you absorb the A into the ket, and you absorb the A dagger into the bra, and it's just this inner product. All that's doing, I need to show you a better picture. Back here, A on B was what you get when you glue the purple surface to the blue surface. All it's saying is that we now regard, well, of course, the whole thing, the purple and blue surfaces glued together defines a state, because it's a surface. And we call that state AB. So that's the state. Great. Why did I write it that way? Well, I define trace of A star A to be the norm of A. So this inequality gives me something I like to call the trace inequality, which is that the trace of A star A times the trace of B star B is greater than or equal to the trace of B star, A star, AB. Okay. It takes a little while to parse, but this is a really easy inequality to prove for normal traces on Hilbert space. It's really easy. It's a really weak bound, but it turns out to be interesting. Okay, so now I know the folks in the perimeter have a banquet to go to. So now this is the part where I just race through stuff to state some results because I don't have time to present them. It would take me a lot longer to present all the details of the proofs at a level where people who don't know about Norman algebras can follow it. But here's the magic. The magic is that this final form of this trace is well defined on the entire von Neumann algebra, not just on the surfaces, but on the, there's well defined on the, sorry, it's well defined on all positive elements of the von Neumann algebra after I take the completion and the weak operator problems. Moreover, when trace A star A is finite, there is still a state that you could write as ket A, whose norm is trace A star A. As a result, that four boundary argument that I went through still holds at a level of the full von Neumann algebra. And this starred equation, this trace inequality, actually holds for the full trace in the von Neumann algebra. And I really want to thank G for patiently explaining to me and holding my hand for the details of all the, you know, convergence arguments showing that this works. So you may not, I'm a little sloppy, but G is a pretty, thorough guy, so you should trust us on this. Okay. But it works. So this is magic. This is absolute magic. Probably all the, any experts on von Neumann algebras just go home and they know what I'm going to say from now on. But I'm going to say it. I'm going to say a few things quickly, and then I'll slow it. Here are the words that come up in every talk about von Neumann algebras. Okay, every von Neumann algebra is a direct sum of so-called von Neumann factors. What are those? They're just algebras with trivial centers, where for every operator, there's some other operator that fails to commute with. Right. Every von Neumann factor, according to mathematicians, is of type 1, 2, or 3. We've all heard that in many talks. It's true. Another fact that comes up, there are no faithful normal semifinite traces on a type 3 factor. Well, our trace does all that. Trust us, I can prove it to you. I didn't prove normality or semifiniteness or faithfulness, but it's true. As our paper will show very shortly. So our factors are not type 3. Great. Another interesting fact. For any such trace on a type 2 factor, there are non-trivial projections with finite and arbitrarily small trace. This is not allowed by our trace inequality. So the trace inequality says trace A star A times trace B star B is greater than or equal to trace B star A star AB. Just set A equals B equals P for some projection P, which means that it's a projection, P squared equals P, and apply the inequality. And the left-hand side is trace P squared, because everything collapses and there are two traces. But the right-hand side, there's only one trace, and these are all just P, and P to a power is P, so it's trace P. So trace P squared is bigger than trace P. Well, we can solve that inequality, right? I think my daughter just learned how to do this in seventh grade. So trace P is either zero or it's bigger than or equal to one. And you can actually, you can show that if the projection is non-trivial, it can't have trace P equal zero. That's what it means to be faithful. So I already claimed that anyway. So the traces of projections can't be arbitrarily small. So our factor algebras are not type two. So they're type one. And then everything else, as I say, is just kind of magic. Here is the quick summary. What you do, and I'll say this in a way, it's quick, but I want to make it sound easy because it kind of is at this point. The way you diagnose things with von Neumann algebras is you look at their centers, which are all the elements that commute with everybody. And it's like quantum mechanics. What do you do? Because it is, because these are operators on the Hilbert space. It is quantum mechanics. And these things are always self-adjoint. Well, so they're all normal. They all commute with their adjoints. In quantum mechanics, you have a bunch of operators that all commute with themselves and each other and their adjoints. What do? You simultaneously diagonalize them. And there's a theorem that says you can do that. So the Hilbert space we're talking about decomposes as a direct sum of simultaneous eigenspaces. Great. And because these are center operators, they commute with everybody in the algebra, which means that nobody in the algebra can move you from one eigenstate to another. And so you can then take the algebra and also decompose it into subalgebras that act non-trivially only within one sector, within one common eigenspace. Basically, by multiplying the algebra element you started with the projection onto the Z sector. Okay, so it just acts non-trivially in one sector. Great. All right. Then in each sector, these algebras must be factors because we've gotten rid of the centers. And so then there's a theorem. Oh, I wanted to mention, sorry, there's also a theorem I can pull out called the either von Neumann or Riefel bicommutant theorem that tells us in our context that the left and right algebras defined by active amplitude boundaries are commutants. In this context for type one, there's a theorem that says that each of these Hilbert space sectors does have a tensor product decomposition. Okay. That's great. Oh, and somehow I feel like I skipped the slide, but here's the other fun fact. By looking at the four boundary Hilbert space, I proved to you that trace P had to either be zero or bigger than one. It turns out there are similar manipulations on the two N boundary Hilbert space that tell you that trace P has to be 0, 1, 2, 3, et cetera, up to n minus 1, or trace bigger than n. Do that for all n, you prove that trace P has to be a positive integer on each of these Z sectors. So it turns out that means that for each Z, there's an integer in Z such that you can reproduce the abstract trace I define as a normal Hilbert space trace, if you add in what I call a hidden sector of dimension n z. So I defined an operator on, there shouldn't be a tilde on the right-hand side, that's confusing. I defined this A star A as an operator on the full Hilbert space, HBV. It turns out there's a theorem that says it's effectively acting only on the left factor, which is something. And then it turns out that you could add in another factor on which effectively you just define this operator to act trivially. And if you do that, that abstract trace I defined is the normal Hilbert space trace, by which I mean the thing you get by summing over, oh, I'm going to type it down here. It's defined in the bottom line where if this is a capital A, this should also be a capital A, where this tilded trace is defined by summing diagonal elements of operators over an orthonormal basis, the usual thing. So I just said a whole bunch of things really quickly that if you're an expert, you say, if you're not an expert, it may take you a while to grasp, but these are the claims in the paper. Okay. So this is kind of where we wanted to go. What this means is that if you're given a density matrix on one of these modified factor spaces, then the sort of algebraic notion of a von Neumann entropy, you define by just, well, the thing defined by the path integral and gluing things together could be used to find an entropy and it agrees with how you calculate the entropy in that tilted Hilbert space. As long as you do one thing I forgot to copy, which is you add in this factor of the identity on C to the N. That's actually down here at the bottom. It's just that there should be a tilde here on the row inside this expression. Okay. And what is this object? Well, everything I've done is really just gluing together path integrals. So row, I could write a, if you give me a state A in my Hilbert space with two boundaries, not a particular Z sector, but the whole Hilbert space, you can make a density matrix by gluing two of those together. And then you can compute a notion of trace, be what you might call the gravitational replica trick, just gluing more things together. And of course, if that represents a path integral, which has some bulk representation as a gravitational theory and some notion of semi-classical limit, then you can write down the Lukacs-Malavacena argument. And in that limit, the entropy of that row is Ryu Takinagi. But if you put everything if you can remember everything I told you and you put it into the standard machinery and turn the crank, I forgot a term, you can show that this entropy can be written in terms in terms of standard entropies on each of these Hilbert spaces. It's just the average of those plus the entropy of mixing term that I forgot to write, okay? where the P's, which also appear in the entropy of Nixon term, are the probability for the state A to appear in this set. Meaning, we said before that we took the whole Hilbert space, and we could write it as a direct sum of these things. It's really just, we agreed that these sectors are labeled by simultaneous eigenvalues of the central operators. So PZ is just the probability that state A has those eigenvalues Z. Okay. So S rho has this nice form where we write things in terms of standard Hilbert space trace and an entropy of mixing term, which is sadly invisible. And I think that's cool. So I'm sorry if I've kept folks in the banquet. Probably you've all run off and are enjoying your soup and drinks. But here's the summary, just to repeat the words very quickly, and then I'll pause and see if there are any comments or questions. What I've said is we want to assume five things about a bulk theory of quantum gravity. We want to assume that it gives us finite complex numbers whenever I hand it smooth boundaries with associated boundary fields that we might think of as finding boundary conditions. If that function from boundary conditions to complex numbers is real, reflection positive, continuous in the very weak sense I described, and a Bayes factorization, I can build a Hilbert space, which is positive definite. There are von Neumann algebras that act on the Hilbert space, which are left and right in some sense. They're type one, and that means the Hilbert space decomposes as a direct sum, and each term in the sum factorizes. And then if you augment this by throwing in those finite dimensional hidden sectors, you find that there is a Hilbert space interpretation of the Ryu-Takayanagi entropy. There's an entropy defined in terms of standard, quote, state counting entropies on the modified Hilbert space, which in this a certain semi-classical limit, assuming the Pachelbel has one, gives you RT. I should just mention as one final comment, hidden sectors are not ridiculous. When I told you that someone clever gave me a path integral that satisfies these axioms, it's okay if they hand me half the theory. Meaning, suppose the full theory allows there to be a red scalar field in the boundary and a blue scalar field in the boundary. There are two kinds of boundary conditions for two different bulk fields. And the full theory allows you to specify both the red field and the blue field. Suppose they only tell me how to do the path integral with the red field, and they only tell me how to compute these numbers. The black box they hand me only computes these numbers when the blue boundary field is zero. Doesn't stop me from writing this argument. But in that context, it wouldn't surprise you that there might still be, quote, hidden sectors, because once they tell me how to add in the blue sources, how to change the blue boundary conditions, you expect to see more structure. So that's a way that you can think of hidden sectors as arising. You can interpret it as someone didn't give you the whole theory and you just can't see part of it. That's an interpretation. We'll see what comes later and we can do this. All right, I should stop talking and we'll see if anyone has any questions. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
Just about so this factorization axiom,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to satisfy in simple models. But you mentioned that perhaps this generalized factorization could replace it.
It's perfectly sufficient. Absolutely perfectly sufficient. Yeah.
What happens in, like, let's say pure JT gravity? Is that not satisfied generalized factorization?
I think it depends on what you mean. The matrix model completion of it certainly satisfies generalized factorization. Pure JT gravity, you have to tell me how well defined that is. I want the full UV completed theory that actually gives me numbers, not an asymptotic series I have to try to sum up.
But so you're saying there's no completion of JT gravity. No completion of JT gravity that is sort of not discrete.
I didn't think I said that. Tell me. Oh, because everything's a matrix model? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm exactly saying that. The fact that this is very, very well said and is a very important thing. Where did it go? You really did lose a slide. there was a slide. Anyway, this quantization condition, the statement that trace P for projection must be an integer, is effectively, if P is a finite dimensional projection, well, maybe that's kind of, maybe it's just in the type one story. Yeah, okay, yes, the type oneness effectively says that must be discrete. See, the following is interesting point, which is a slight subtlety. Where was I going? Oh, factorization. I think if you, let's put it this way. Suppose instead of having a matrix as the dual, you have an operator with continuous spectrum. And suppose you just wanted to claim that the Hamiltonian, that the, yeah, okay, suppose that you're looking at one operator, which generates some commutative von Neumann algebra, and it has a continuous spectrum. I think that still satisfies all these axioms. It's just that, yeah, I think that still satisfies. So I guess I don't want to say that there's no completion, which I don't want to say that all completions are discrete.
But then it would not be type one, right? The
or sure.
If the operator has a continuous spectrum, then isn't there a problem with the
because the theory is so simple and so stupid. There's only one operator. Okay. Actually, first of all, it could be more than one operator. So you know, L2 of R is, let's just get a few things, let's remind ourselves of a few things. L2 of R, our favorite Hilbert space, has many operators on it with continuous spectra. And the full algebra of bounded operators on any Hilbert space, including L2 of R, is type one. So there's no fundamental tension between type oneness and continuous spectra. It's just that in most cases, I'll explain the exception in a moment. Continuous spectra give you divergent entropies.
Right. There isn't a conflict between continuous spectrum type one and having finite boundary partition functions?
Unfortunately, not in the JT case where it's a really stupid, simple theory. If there's a continuous, because everything in JT commutes with the Hamiltonian lies in the center. And therefore, the type 1 von Neumann algebras are actually the trivial, the type 1 non-von Neumann factors are the trivial one-dimensional algebras that act on each eigenspace. So in this case, what you end up with is this formula here, correctly written as an integral, although there should be an entry of mixing term, which is also correctly written as an integral, and it can be an integral. So these center sectors can be continuous in an interesting way. The subsectors associated with diagonalizing the center, well, again, it could be L2 of R, there could be operators in there that are continuous, but sort of the thing you'd call the Hamiltonian, the thing computed by these partition functions in the obvious way, couldn't have continuous spectra. So the problem is that JT without matter is so simple it allows this exception. You would expect that JT gravity with matter would not have that kind of property and would therefore have to be discrete.
Okay, I see. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's an annoying technicality.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you hear me?
I can. Can't see. I don't know if I can see you, but I can hear you. Oh, go ahead.
So could you comment on whether something like this could be extended to generalized entropy? Could you comment on the dot, dot, dot terms?
Oh, that's trivial. That's all. I mean, it's trivial because I've made this whole setup so that it reduces to, okay. All I've done is made a setup where it's interesting to glue boundaries together.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I said is, suppose this black box that Douglas handed me that computes all my path integrals and finds my theory has some limit where I could think of it as being associated with a standard gravitational, quote, path integral, and where I can do the usual kind of saddle point calculations and then proceed. Well, in that case, I'm just doing standard saddle point calculations for boundaries where I glue things together. This is what Lefkowitz-Maldacena did. It's what Faulkner-Lefkowitz-Maldacena did. It's what Zhidong did to compute higher derivative corrections. And so it's all the same. So the dot, dot, dots are the usual dot, dot, dots, because all I've done is bolted on to the usual frame.
Got it. Thanks.
Sure.
Are there any other questions? All right, if not, let's thank Don again.
No hands raised.
Yes, I have a question.
Oh, there's a question?
Yeah.
Yes, sorry. So my question concerns what the moral of the talk regarding the RT formula is. Is your claim that the entanglement entropy computed by the RT formula is properly an entanglement entropy, like a renormalized entanglement entropy computed with respect to this trace? The trace for this von Neumann algebra that you constructed?
My claim is that in any, I'll make this claim. In any UV completion of a quantum gravity theory in asymptotic locally ADS space, there is a quantity, which is an entropy, and it's a real entropy. You don't have to say renormalized entropy. It's an entropy in the usual sense. You can compute it by taking traces over Hilbert spaces, and when the RT entropy is finite, those traces over Hilbert spaces actually converge. And so my claim is that any UV completion of a bulk quantum gravity theory has enough structure that there is an entropy defined on it whose semi-classical limit is the RT entropy.
Okay, so in this argument, why do you say that this is, that why do you have to construct a quantity which you say is an entropy, a notion of entropy, instead of saying that simply that this is the Hilbert space in entropy to begin with? I'm sorry, let me rephrase my question. Is the algebra of operators that you've constructed for this Hilbert space the full Banach algebra of operators on that Hilbert space?
No, it's not. It might be, but it doesn't have to be, because this construction allows the algebra I construct to have a non-trivial center.
Right, okay.
So up to that, yes. So it is. So the tensor product of the left and right von Neumann algebra I constructed is the full algebra bounded operators on each Z sector, once you've diagonalized the sectors. So it is it the trace? Well, and is it the entropy? Well, it's a question of which Hilbert space, okay? Because it's a lot to absorb, but for the path integral that agrees with RT to be the entropy, we have to include certain things I called hidden sectors, these finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I've shown that there is a Hilbert space on which RT is the entropy, if you will. Okay. And I leave it to you to tell me what the right Hilbert space for the theory actually was. And again, what I said is that the structure is kind of consistent, certainly from the axioms I've got. I don't think you could get more, because it might be that someone only gave me part of the theory. And if they hadn't told me how to compute some observables, then of course there are hidden sectors that I can't resolve. Entirely reasonable, but that's where I am.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other reasons? All right, thank you all again.
Thank you very much.